Blog Talk Radio.
Has to be the fates. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Masonic Effects. You found us. We found each other. Well, I'm sitting here in a snowbank. I'm enjoying the winter, the passing of winter, and every day the days are getting a little longer. And I know, it just makes me think of all those big old boulders stuck in fields all over the place where people like you and me once went to find answers, to find some comfort. And it was the best that we could do at the time. Man, we've always done that. And so rather than sneer at that and think, oh, I'm foolish old timers, they were adaptive because they were human. they figured it out. It's a show today that will be, I think, filled with that sense of amazement, the irony, not like, oh my goodness, what's that? You know, we save that for the James Webb Telescope adventures every day. What more are we learning about that universe that's just expanding? It sort of blows your mind, and it's really hard to grasp this sense of expansion and just a sense of movement. I just find that fascinating. But when I extrapolate, when I play it back and I begin to think about how it might, you know, selfish and all that ego stuff, how does this apply to me, or how can I apply any of this to me? It's very, very interesting, because my perspective is changing. It was like when I first learned that that big nuclear reactor son of ours is consuming fuel, and just like around here, you know, you dip into the groundwater and you drain aquifers that have taken hundreds of thousands of years to fill, and we empty it in 10. You might not be around for it to refill itself, you know, 100,000 years or a million years. It's not like that. That moment when I realized that the sun is a consumer, it's consuming. What we know is that that's not infinite. But we don't know what happens after that. Oh, except we do. We know that Andromeda is going to, this whole galaxy is just going to be, is moving toward us. And eventually our galaxy is going to be on a course where we're going to intersect. And that ought to be interesting. Of course, everything's expanding. So that's not to say we can predict the fates. Eh? We can second guess the fates. We've done that. I'll leave all of that to Shakespeare. I think you might want to consider it. It's lovely. There is no long and the short of it. There's just wonder. We're in people with how do I say it? How do you, what word do you use for weak-minded or you know, I don't have a word for it. There, it's not an inclination everybody's interested in. And it does fit into some kind of hierarchy, I think. You have to have, if you're freezing, if you're homeless, if you're hungry, you're not going to be necessarily thinking about these existential threats. The existential threat is primary. That threat is growing around me. With people around me are suffering, and yet I can be pretty immune to it. I can just blinker myself and pretend. I'm pretty good at that, especially in this wonderful country I'm in. We're taught to pretend, to ignore, to trust what we ought not to, or we ought to question. We've done that for a while, but in all fairness, we're coming of age. This is a young nation maturing, and you know that going through life ain't pretty. It is we're looking deep into the soul of the country, and we're seeing the good and the bad and the ugly, and so the truth unvarnished. And of course the media and our we've got a really exploitive politic here that just exploits us, like our economic system's based on it. But oops, sorry, I didn't say that out loud. But it can be overwhelming. The media will build up the tensions because they have that sense that they've told us this is what sells, this is what we are collectively interested in. If they give us every day, if we turned on our equipment, our phones or iPads or laptops, and they were full of enriching learning experiences, we could argue, who's at the switch, who's designing enrichment, but we would also know. We would also know collectively, we'd know more about ourselves collectively, all 8 billion of us and growing. What is it that we have in common? And we would know that by the attachment to these ideas. Could we be taught? Well, yeah, we could. And that media is a direct link to advancement. And it's not to teach somebody like you or I, perhaps, who has the advantage of some formal education, but it certainly looks like it's not doing enough, or even acknowledging the fact that there are people struggling who are intelligent and can benefit and will and would benefit from exposure to ideas. So if any of you are out there, if you looked at children's programming, there's some incredibly innovative and creative programs happening that are teaching children about the world we're living in. They're teaching them about engineering and different philosophies, only it's put across in a way that a child can digest. So it's not like they're talking to some stuffy old man my age and expecting a four-year-old to understand the thoughts of somebody with so much baggage. These are little minds. These are emerging minds. They're still developing at that age, and then what we find that it's like teaching language. We're not necessarily born knowing language. I take that back because we seem to have the ability to, a baby seems to have the ability to understand far more than it can say, because, you know, it doesn't have control of the musculature in the process of little grunts of puffs of air. It's remarkable that our position to our thinking about this mass amount of knowledge that's out there is no less overwhelming when you put it into context, folks. The context is your mind. I'm saying this to blow smoke here. The mind, that which sits behind those eyes and between those ears, is far more complex than anything. Any amount of information that we feel is imploding on us. Like, get a grip. It's the other way around. Like, the what's happening around us is catch up, catching up with a capacity. And well, we're looking at things ethically, as we tend to do. Some things we know we can go in all kinds of directions, not all of them healthy, but they don't start off that way until we make those findings. It's like I look up, and I'm sure our ancestors looked up at the sunrise, and we made the appropriate sacrifices and acknowledgments. But they didn't necessarily know what was coming next. And we had that hopefulness that this is going to make things a little better. And unless you can come up with something better, join us, you know. And if you haven't joined us, this is a big scary world out there. And the circumstance of, let's say, it's a crop failure or an extended winter, mean we all die. Well, of course, we're going to want you on board. Or are you feeling oppressed about that? Well, just go over there in the side of the ditch and lie down, because that's the way life is. We work better. We do things when we're on the same wavelength. We do some incredible things. Incredible things happen. But to get there, oh my goodness, to get there and find those common wavelengths, that's a different task. That's a different task. A bureaucrat might be sent to me or some representative of people might be sent to me and offering and displaying some stereotype, some role, you know. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the behavior is what governs his heart and his mind. Does he know better? Does he think about his mom and his family and his mates? And what's in their best interest? Not everybody, but the world isn't run on exceptions. Humanity isn't about exceptions. What would we be like without the eccentricity of the Brits? We would, I shudder to think. A world with no Monty Python, just not going to happen. It just wouldn't be right. Of course, we have exceptions to the rule. That doesn't define the rest. That doesn't define the whole. You can break this down into, you know, you can think about the DNA and the constant mutation, adaptation that we undergo, our species, like all species, undergoes in order to survive, in order to perpetuate our species. And we know that happens around, and some of those mixtures aren't great. Some of them are. That's the ones we pay attention to. But the ones that are beneficial, they go on unnoticed. They go on unnoticed. We'll just like we used to in the old days, a long, long time ago. We'll ascribe those conditions to something supernatural. Now, once upon a time, we declared that autism was something that was wrong, and very little understanding, and now we're finding that it's quite an amazing process that we're just beginning to scratch the surface. But you could say that about, you know, we could talk about that, the human condition, but we could say pretty much the same thing about a lot of things that are commonplace in the world that I live in. The order comes, this kind of order and advantage comes at a price. We accept, like you and I, that there are certain rules and laws that govern us, and in exchange for living in the largesse, in the safety and enjoying benefits of this culture, we also accept the judgments of the laws. Not that we like them, but they're part of the gig. They come with the turf. You want the positives, it comes with that balance point. And we need those. We need some kind of rule to give us a bit of order, so that we can stay out of each other's lanes. You know, there's just not a clamor. And it's okay if there's only you and me walking down the path toward each other in the woods, But we brought our friends. You brought your friends, and so we need which side, left or right? you know where I'm going with this. It's a good show today, but. I'm losing myself sometimes here. Good show. The commentary enhancement, I think you're going to love it. The poetry. Oh, Walt Whitman. I found a good piece. And I was in a very introspective mood. So this is poetry that lends itself to word introspection. Well, of course it would. This is Masonic Effects. Have greetings for we've added somebody. I'll go through the list and maybe frequent flyers who tune us in will recognize who's the country that's been added. And I would say this one is for the very first time in, 11 years of the show? Are we, yeah. Get this. Thank you and acknowledgements to, and I only do this because it feels good to do, to the listeners from Japan, thank you. From Canada, of course. It's a pleasure. Huge. USA, Brazil, and Ethiopia, and South Sudan, and Zambia, and listeners from Ireland, and from Pakistan, and from the United Kingdom, and Oman, and Latvia, and New Zealand, and China. And last of all on our list here is Russia. We have listeners tuning in. Yeah, this isn't to flaunt anything at anybody, but I'm very proud that pleased that the show has a more universal appeal. And that tells me that tells me and you something, that we're talking here about things that resonate through the human condition. And I don't think you could accuse me of having a sense of entitlement or superiority. This is a homage to the brilliance of this Masonic bundle, this our process. We've been given that, whether we warranted it at the time or whether the people that gave us that opportunity knew anything about the depths and ethics of the order. Park that. That's another issue. Park it. Put it on the shelf. It's big. But we have that opportunity. And by hook or by crook, we're fortunate. Now, some men will think that, and they do believe, they come into the order, and the order is an end in itself. The whole design matters little to that person because of the clamor of what Masonry represents symbolically to them. It's a coming of age. It's a deepening of awareness. Now, for some men, a major important step. The other side of that, I think it's not just two facets, but the other position, one other position is that Masonry is a means to an end. And what that end is, well, you and I have discussions about that, but it's a means. It's like a flow through. It's a flow through of ideas. In a way, it is structured the way a university does, and university is curating readings. It's going through all the material and presenting, exposing us, these students that have more opinion than fact. You know, let's put them around the experts and people that are able to explain. And we like to be measured. You pay careful attention, but you need to be able to retain that information. Today, that's gone, you know, topsy-turvy because memorizing it is still important, but in a much, much different way. We need to know what the information is, and we need to know how to access it when we need it. So it's, what did a friend of mine call it, ascribed intelligence? you know, acquired intelligence. You're accumulating all this data. Well, now writing is so much easier than it was. But, you know, in my old age and my nostalgia, I can say, gee, I used to like those trips to the library. And I did. And I did. But I also remember that it is more convenient for me to be able to stay focused on my train of thought and access information as the questions come up come to mind from my desk. Now it's discovery, and what drives all of this, as you've heard me say, be patient. There's no clamor. It's not a competition. Find the question, and that's how it all. And that's how it builds. Why and what? And is that true? You know, does that make sense? Yes. Sometimes I like to have. I understand science fiction. Thank you, Stanislaw Lem. And you know, what are the big ones? Heinlein and Ursula Le Guin, just big, you know, that guy. And we acquire information through literature. Thank you, Shakespeare. He penetrates the skin, doesn't he? It's like he's talking about some of that emotional conflict that we that we experience, and it's like, who told Shakespeare? Only did he exploit self actualization? Is that what we're talking about here? Was William just a guy that got it and then he wrote it down in poems and then watched the reaction? I'm not going to tell you what this is. I'm not going to tell you what Hamlet's about. Watch it. And what's it tell you? Ah, there you go. Anyway, the show, we'll cut that off for now. The show is audacious, I hope. And Walt Whitman fits in the history, more that idea of wisdom. And think about this, the structure of the show, kind of transparent. We have a commentary. We have history, which I equate with wisdom. We have poetry, which I equate with strength and courage. And we have music. Ah, beauty. Works for me. I hope you enjoy. Sit back. Of course. Miles Davis. On the Kind of Blue album. I haven't played that for years. On purpose. If I wanted to be thinking, is what we're doing about assessing what our life has meant to us, and when we've done that. Is that what leads us to explore meaning and alternatives? Is it not just these ideas floating around us, but a reaction, what we're doing, the process? Is it a reaction to that assessment of self? And I think it's a reasonable question. We are in a group that employs initiation. A lot of times we don't seem to respect what that is about, the importance of that. So the sonic effects, hopefully we'll scratch off a bit of the old plaster and see the fresco underneath, enhancement. And I mean that, this is uplifting. Here we are, 421 years after we bothered writing down notes that we met and talked. I'm not sure whether we were calling ourselves brethren and masons. I'm not sure. Probably not. Another generation going through life for the first time, attempting an eyes wide open. Every generation does that. We might as well attempt to enjoy a life without dress rehearsals. We don't have that. The best we can do is learn from the experience of people we trust, the writings that have been passed down. But as well, we have a discernment. We need to have some ethical sense to understand. It wasn't like there was this sense of purity, this pool of pure thought, and we're on the contaminated end of it. We still are repeating. Theater critics and students will know that we're still repeating the fundamental themes of Greek theater, comedy, tragedy, drama. You know, we still do that over and over and over in little variations, and it's beautiful. But we also have barbarism as part of our human history, and the effort to control through history. Fortunately, we can send all these lovely children of despots can head toward the best universities and be well trained, but that does not mean that their fixed point is going to shift. It means they can be trained in Western thought and discernment, but it does not mean that their values are going to be penetrated by the sciences. Doesn't mean that. Oh, I wish it would. We might as well, as I say, attempt to enjoy life without dress rehearsal. Making the best of the time we have without isolating is a natural thought. It comes when we realize the metaphor is about us opening our dark temple to a light. It's a simple, powerful idea, one that satisfies on different levels. It does not dissolve unfairness. It does not make us more or less competitive. It acknowledges each has agency, each of us. All the insights of Freemasonry were unexplored. Do the insights exist? Is it like the tree falling in the forest when nobody is around? Does it make a sound? These are conventions we use to encourage observation. Thankfully, Masonry outlines some basic values as context, so that when we pass a tree or walk past a crowd in the park, we can easily examine and place those artifacts for us to examine and affirm. Everyone likes to feel important. Being observant makes us feel that way, especially when we realize the only difference is living with a purpose in mind versus getting through the day. If you think as I do, being accurate or thoughtful or observant in a crowded room in which you are the only one does not detract at all. It connects us with those conversations we had more than 421 years ago. We didn't sit down and immediately begin taking minutes. Somebody said, "These are good conversations. Maybe we ought to be writing this down." We can only guess how many years these, quote, Masonic conversations happened. So who was first? It's absurd to think. Who cares? The conversation, once started, has never ended. It is made more interesting when we share what we have been reading, studying, thinking. Absorbing the ideas of others has always been a satisfying process. So encourage the pints to be filled, loosen tongues to the extent the truth surfaces, and watch truth. And remember the Persian king, you can tell me. would accumulate, bring all his generals together. And this is the story about the doing it twice, making major strategic decisions twice. All his generals completely sober and talk about the issues at hand, the strategies, principles. And then record it. He had scribes record it. And then bring the group together again for a more raucous approach. Everybody's drinking and carrying on, addressing the same question. And again, the scribes are writing down the results. And the when those two opinions merged, that was considered the path forward, the strategy most reliable. What does that say? It's an interesting thought, isn't it? That we become less inhibited, of course, when we're drinking, with the effect of alcohol, when we're a little intoxicated. And of course, the homage here is to the recognitions to the Greeks and to the Persians, who could just, you didn't pour your own. You had staff around that would just keep us at that level. Chatter, not too much, not falling asleep, not passing out. Add a little more water to the bowl if that's happening. And then add a little more thick wine, dense wine, if it's becoming a little too normal. Enhancement. I think the order does that. But the conversation about where I am in this precinct is just beginning. But there's, my goodness, is there ever such a strong reaction to it? It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. Still, there's pounding those fists in the day. I'm in charge of my own thinking. And it doesn't bring everybody to a level of awareness together. No. Thank goodness. But the alternative is out there. There's not so much hesitation about having intelligent conversation. And when people roll their eyes, oh, here we go again. Well, yeah, go away. This is what, unless you can come up with a more, and it's not exhaustive. These are, it's the context. You walk into a lodge room, that's context. Pay attention to it, eh, gents. And offer something serious in a tasteful way, thoughtful, nuanced conversation. Here, speaking of nuanced conversation, for those of you who are new to the work of Coleman Hawkins, this is some of his work from 1956. Some of you youngsters won't remember this, but this is the Hawk in Hi-Fi. Yeah. Body and soul. Like I always say, if you're going to do it right. Eh? Thanks. Beautiful music. Beautiful music. An interesting orchestration. That's 1956. Now I turn to the reflection. Eh? This is where the part of the show that we talk about poetry, leaning in to the detail, to seeing things and talking about them and writing the things, seeing things that aren't necessarily evident if you're just on that gerbil wheel, you're just rushing through life, and you're dealing with whatever's impacting you. This is more about those moments when you're just you have that sense. I'm presuming that the people tuning in here have a sense of the bittersweetness of life. It isn't always pretty. It isn't always. But you're listening to somebody that doesn't think that the existence is orchestrated. It is curious and it's interesting, but it's, I think it's unfolding around us. There's no doubt that if you agree that if you think that, all these new neutrinos blasting through us, all of this is progress, it's just the progress of some chemical event, and there's light, and none of this stops, the universe doesn't stop because we want it to stop. with the fly in the ointment, it's not so much the fly in the ointment. It's like the, you know, if there's one red daisy in a field of white daisies, that's us. We have this, what makes this so darn challenging is consciousness. I'm going to say this, you know, I know you jump all over it. A rock, I don't think a rock has consciousness. A tree, maybe. The little critters that are running around here, all the squirrels and groundhogs and opossums and the birds, maybe they have consciousness too. Us, definitely. And don't be too harsh on us. What do we do with it? We're still learning. We'll get back to you when we figure that out. My goodness, we've only been around a couple hundred thousand years, eh? So, you know, cut us a bit of slack, man. You do know we're talking about a conscious awareness, right? You know, yeah. And you do know that we're aware that we have different histories and different lived experiences. So, and for anybody pretending that we can just impose, you know, some kind of social structure on the world, surprise, surprise, doesn't quite work out that way. This is the poetry of a time when there was a nation of aspiration. It wasn't the nation as we see it today that is. That has suffered from its indulgences and didn't know when to turn them off. It's gone on, and you know, like everything else, you have a good thing, but if you do too much of it, it goes too far, you bad things happen, and that's what's going on. Walt Whitman's an interesting guy. This is a poem that when it was first, this is Introspection 101 here. It's called The Song of Myself, but the first time it was published in 1855, didn't have a title. It was simply Walt Whitman. And then years later, that was in 1860. And then 25 years, 30 years, 55, 65, 75, 85, you know, almost 25, 26 years. He changed the title to Song of Myself in 1881. And the changes in the title are significant because it indicates the growth of the meaning of this poem. Oh, I would not ever impose any of my thinking on the world. My gosh, oh, far from it. I go to an opera and then I sit there in the audience and I let myself be elevated by the music and the themes and what I'm seeing on the stage. I let Shakespeare's dialogues drip into my mind. And then I walk away thinking, because he makes me, he's a bit of an irritant, you know. He makes me go back and try and decipher what he's saying in this old language. So he doesn't just blurt it out. Oh, this is about love unrequited. This is about, you know, this is about deception. He gives us the material and then we find that. And it's like over the years we've analyzed his work. And then so we have what it seems to be the, you know, agreed upon themes. And then we can walk in saying, huh, did I see that? Did I see that? Is that all? And of course, when you begin to ask those questions, they're kind of silly. Is that all? Well, no, there's always something more. So you go back. Mm-hmm. That's the intoxication of Shakespeare. I would like to have had a chance to meet the man, sit down. And if you were asking me who I would like to have a dinner with, he would be one of the people. I think the other one would be Elizabeth Taylor, because just she lived such an interesting life. And there's another one, but we'll save that for later. Here, in this poem, there are three important themes. It's the idea of the self, and the identification of the self with other selves. Not too scary. And then it's the poet's relationship with the elements of nature and the universe. And that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, you know, thinking about the inner And then you're thinking about the outer. That's above, so below for some of you. Houses and rooms represent civilization, and perfumes signify individual selves. Ah, the senses, eh? And the atmosphere symbolizes the universal self. The self is conceived as a spiritual entity, and that remains relatively permanent in and through the changing flux of ideas and experiences as the poetry flows. That's a consciousness, conscious life. The self comprises ideas and experiences and psychological states and spiritual insights. Now, I kind of like that framework. Does that capture us? Well, it ought. If you cut yourself a little bit of slack, think of yourself that way. Oh, yeah, you can be trapped. You know, you have those old mind habits. But think of yourself this way. You can park all that stuff, all that darkness and, you know, the bleakness, whatever, self-defeating kinds of thoughts. You can keep that. It's not going to go away. But what about this? And then if you absorb this, ideas, experiences, psychological safety, you have that kind of awareness. I want to ask you, in a year or two, what effect does that have on your thinking? To Whitman, the self is both individual and universal, as we can say, as we see. Man has an individual self, whereas the world or cosmos has a universal or cosmic self. Now, back in the day, they were using terms like man to represent, it's a derivative, you know, it's a derivative word. But there was a time when it wasn't distinct, wasn't making a distinction, a gender distinction. Today, it's breathtaking. And no, I'm not saying that today we have invented the woke culture. No. We even the term from the 40s and 50s out of what, Harlem? So yeah, we're just figuring it out again. We're figuring it out again. And yet, you know, we maintain the identity of the individual self and a desire to merge with the universal self. And that's kind of interesting. Don't tell me what to do. You know, that, my first reaction, what, wait, I'm a skeptic. But that sense, yeah, I kind of like it. I kind of like it. I like the influence that we bring to the universal self. And that involves an identification with the poet's self, with mankind, and the mystical union of the poet with the great architect of the universe. So this is a good example of stylistic features of the overall book that was published, Leaves of Grass, the collection, and Whitman's style of reflection on individualism. So you can imagine back in the day, the late 19th century, how appealing this would be. As he says, I sometimes think the leaves is only a language experiment. Words for Whitman have both a natural and spiritual significance. Here, you like it's an epic poem, and it's crammed with significant detail, and it's a six section. You know, there's so many sections. So I'm only going to give you a little sample. This is from the 1892 version. He touched it up. It's like try to pull the palette and the paints away from an artist when he's walking past his work. You'll see it hanging in the museum and he'll want to touch it up. You know, he hasn't finished. I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loathe and invite my soul. I lean and loathe at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. And I, now 37 years old, in perfect health, begin, hoping to cease not until death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check with original energy. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. The cells are crowded with perfumes. I breathe the fragrance myself. I know it, and I like it. The distillation would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it. The atmosphere is not perfume. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank at the wood and become undisguised and naked, and I am mad for it to be in contact with me. Huh. This is where I'll stop. Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them for yourself. That is a small part of this poem. Sort of feels good to the ear. You really do need time alone with this music, Thelonious Monk. You really do. So it is. It draws you in. Not to an acquired taste. Here, today we're wrapping up. I think we're trying to put some, draw some conclusions. Out of Margaret Jacobs' work, Living the Enlightenment, and really is addressing the question about the impact of the Enlightenment on humanity. And we find history is cautioning us that we men made this an adventure in misogyny. And so the thinking was that very few women actually experienced the benefits of the progress of the Enlightenment. And she goes to, turns our attention to the records in The Hague, Masonic records in The Hague, that address this question. And as she points out in her work today, that it, the discussion went on for a very, very long time. And we know that because the lodges that were promoting this, were addressing this, ceased to exist. Now that's not a proof of maleness or of intellectual superiority or correctness. You know, in any of that, it is what it is. The lodges ceased to exist, but the question lingered. And it, at the time, remember that some of these ideas were considered quite radical, and there was that notion that Masonry was a bit edgy, huh? And that it was dealing with ideas above its station. Here we have a society based on, you know, social strata, and here this upstart organization was breaking the rules. It was talking about universality and equality. How dare them? How dare them? We have order. We have the power of the church and state. It's unassailable. How dare them question it? But question it did. And we know, and of course, Jacobs makes it very clear that what we're looking at here is a pushback on the profane. To our credit, we dealt with, we were and we are dealing with this question. not everybody can. I'll admit that. You know, I've seen the topic brought up, and it was handled grown men talking as if they were 14 and 15 year old boys. Absolutely silly. And so they're, you know, being manly and being silly at the same time, and unaware how that, again, it is what it is. But the question lingers, and it keeps there are answers, and I'm not going to get into that on a personal level today. There's a reaction, but it's more thoughtful than political. And we have to look at, as she points out, we have to look at to France for widespread evidence of lodges for both men and women. The French lodges of adoption in the late 1780s were, as a Viennese brother described them, without a doubt one of the most noteworthy new developments in the world of masonry. The scholar who has written most about these lodges is Janet Burke, and she sees them tied inextricably to French aristocratic society and to women of high birth with a degree of economic independence and certainly great wealth. They were particularly prevalent among the lesser nobility, among women whose husbands were minor government officials and were also Freemasons. As we shall see in the case of Strasbourg, lodges for women could also be found amongst the highest nobility. So as in the L'Éloge du Juste, the emphasis on virtue appears in the justifications published for the French lodges. Masonry is the school, it's quoted, of decency and virtue, said the words of one Song Sun for a newly initiated sister. We will conduct ourselves by virtue in the milieu of a temple consecrated to this goddess. The lodges were more than simply centers for virtue or social influence or places where the lesser nobility mixed with the greater. For the French women who Janet Burke has studied, Freemasonry became a way of life. It provided a locus for their charitable activities and, most important, a center for female friendship and conviviality. The mysticisms we noted at L'Éloge du Juste was widespread in the French lodges of adoption, which employed the rituals of the Scottish Rite, then vastly elaborated upon. This mysticism was fueled by Masonic theosophies active in the adoptive lodges, as well as mesmerism, a cult of spiritual healing imported from France by the Austrian mystic Franz Anton Mesmer. Spiritualism appears to have added to the emotional force of the Masonic ceremonies, which in adoptive Freemasonry, as in the male lodges, emphasized not simply friendship, but equality and fraternity. As one Masonic song from 1775 put it, friendship among the common people is nothing more than a shadow, a disguise. Among us, it is a sentiment as solid as it is sincere. That needs to be digested, doesn't it? To be digested. I think in a way, I'm trying to prepare for the moment when some very precise legal minds decide to sue Freemasonry for a violation of charter rights. It's simply scraping the dust off this old debate discussion. And as it goes, as it happens, there are women Freemasons where I am and doing quite well and not so much interested in blending with male-only lodges. It's like we get it. You can practice gender specificity has a place in masonry, so we get it. So is it blocked? No. This one, the logic is a little loose, isn't it? A little loose. if I banned you from this golf course, this private elite course, and had some criteria for that, and it doesn't mean that you would be banned from all golf courses all over the place, but why the exception? What gives people the right to be an exception? Sometime we should get into the legalese of these things. Do you think? I wonder. I wonder if it's that easy or that complicated. But this is one that will stay with us, and hopefully our poets will write about it, and our scholars will keep the discussion alive. It's not going to go away. It's unfinished, and it's meaningful. Believe this, that masonry has meaningful elements to it. So does Jerry Mulligan. Try this, Nightlights.
Well, I find that
our time is winding up right now, at least the time that I've set aside for us to sit down together. Thanks for pulling a chair in and relaxing. Remember, I try and encourage the use of your favorite beverage while you're listening to this. We'll be back in a week's time with another commentary. And may the Creator be willing, all of us will be in attendance. And we'll go from there. What comes next? Always the question. So thank you for the support from you is appreciated. Yeah, I have to admit, the craft. Let me just say the craft is unfolding, and the limits that we see have, I think, more to do with the limits of self understanding than anything else. It seems to work beautifully where human beings have done a little bit of work, have asked some questions. Man, when do you get tired? Is there any given day when we declare that Socrates questions a life unexamined is not worth living? Well, we're just going to erase that. Still provocative. So right now, I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to bundle myself up against the cold. I'm going to keep this thought in mind and this conversation that we're having, and I'm going to go for a long walk. Then I'm just breathe in the cold air and look at the trees without any leaves, and everything white. It's cleansing. And I wish that you commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And for some of you, if you can do it under a cloak of anonymity, not to impose, no, to enhance, not to impose. And how you do that is simply by being observant, simply. I figure out the universe. It's simple. Just send the James Webb telescope. Simple, my goodness.